Chapter 59. Corvin Danevis approached Garriston as the sun set. The outer walls of Garriston, of course, had long ago been demolished. During the Prism's War, Corvin never thought of it as the false Prism's War, he had set men to working on rebuilding them, but there just hadn't been time. The outer wall had been built to shield a city of hundreds of thousands. At the time of the war, there had been perhaps 90,000. There had been no way to protect them all. The irrigation canals that could have been watering all the land between the outer walls and the inner walls were broken, except for one or two, but the inner walls still stood, as did the ladies. The ladies, mostly now stripped of associations with the goddess Anat, guarded each gate. Each was an enormous white statue incorporated into the wall itself. Each had represented an aspect of Anat. The guardian was the colossus standing astride the entrance to the bay. The mother guarded the south gate, heavily pregnant, defiant, dagger-bared. The hag guarded the west gate, leaning heavily on a staff. The lover lay across the river gate to the east. For reasons Corvin had never understood, the lover was depicted perhaps in her 30s, while the mother was depicted as very young, perhaps still in her teens. Each was carved of the most expensive, faintly translucent white marble, such as was only available in Perea. Orholm alone knew how they'd shipped so much this far. The statues, luckily, had been coated in the finest sealed yellow luxin, all of one piece. Astounding work. The city had been invaded at least 3 times, and still the ladies were unmarked, even after the fiery devastation of the great conflagration. Anat, the Lady of the Desert, the fiery mistress, the sub-red, had been the goddess of all hot passions, wrath, protection, vengeance, possessive love, and furious lovemaking. When Lucidonius had taken the city for Orholm and eliminated the cult, his followers had wanted to tear down the statues, which, granted, would have taken some powerful drafters. Famously, Lucidonius had stopped them, saying, "Tear down only what is false." Several times in the intervening centuries, zealous Prisms had wanted to tear down the pagan relics anyway, but each time the city had threatened war. Until the Prisms' War, Garriston had had enough military power that a threat of going to war with her was daunting. Corvin had never approached the lover at sunset. As with the other ladies, her body was incorporated into the gate. She lay on her back, back arched over the river, feet planted, her knees forming a tower on one bank, hands entwined in her hair, elbows rising to form the tower on the other bank. She was clad only in veils, and before the war, a portcullis could be lowered from her arched body into the river, its iron and steel hammered into shape so that they looked like a continuation of her veils. But in the war, the portcullis had been broken and never replaced. The sight of her still took Corvin's breath. With the sun setting, the thin yellow luxin sealing the statue, usually nearly invisible, was set alight. The yellow was like golden bronze skin, fading slowly as Corvin walked and the sun sank, finally leaving only a welcoming silhouette, a wife waiting a bed for her long-absent husband. It sent a pang through him. He could never come here without thinking of Cora, his first wife, Liv's mother. Cora had greeted him like that once, lying abed, clad only in veils, deliberately mimicking the lover when Corvin had returned to her. Even now, 18 years later, grief and remembered desire and joy and love twined in his breast. Corvin had remarried in Recton, 2 years after Cora's death, but marrying El had been more to give Liv a mother than for love. 3 years later, El had been murdered by an assassin who'd finally tracked Corvin down. Corvin had considered moving, but the Alcaldessa begged him to stay, and Kip was there. So he'd stayed. But he'd not remarried again, not even with the overwhelming number of women for every man in Recton and the constant carping of the would-be matchmakers. He couldn't love as he had loved before. Losing another woman he loved as much as he'd loved Cora would kill him. And it wasn't fair to ask another woman to act as mother to his daughter if he wasn't willing to love her with his whole heart. Corvin no longer had a whole heart to give. He trudged on, past farms with their thin, but ripening crops of spelt and barley, trying not to look at the lover stretched luxuriously before him. Reaching the gate, which opened through the spilling tresses of her hair, he joined the line of men and women heading back into the city, brushing past those heading back out for the night. He kept his eyes down as he passed between two Hrothgari guards, who had still been on their mother's knees during the war. They were barely paying any attention to the stream of people passing by them, however. One was leaning against the lover's cascading hair, his foot propped against the rippling stone, his straw petasos, the characteristic Hrothgari broad-brimmed hat, thrown back to hang from his neck now that the sun wasn't beating down on them.
"Think he's here for?" he was asking. "Scorch me if I know, but they say he threw Governor Kressos into the bay. I suppose we'll—"
Corvin couldn't hear any more without pausing, and pausing meant inviting attention. Inviting attention might mean making eye contact. And with Corvin's red-haloed eyes, that wasn't a good idea. So someone powerful had come to Garriston. But who was powerful enough to throw a governor in the bay? Corvin didn't know anything about this Governor Kressos, but the Hrothgari royal family had half a dozen young princes. Most likely one of them had been sent to help oversee the withdrawal from Garriston. No one else would dare throw a Hrothgari governor into the sea. An impulsive prince actually might be better for Corvin's purposes than a comfortable governor. Harder to deal with at first, but more likely to prepare for war, and war was what Corvin was bringing, like it or not. As he passed through the city, he found himself analyzing it like the general he used to be. King Haradul might be a monster, but the Hrothgari were the occupiers. Who would the people of Garriston join? And would they join enthusiastically or not? As Corvin walked, he paid particular attention to the Hrothgari soldiers. At times the men walked singly, running errands for their commanders, or simply heading back to barracks or out to taverns. He saw a soldier get jostled on accident by a vendor closing his carpet stall, who backed up too quickly. The soldier pushed past like it was an annoyance, but never checked his back. The vendor, a native Tyrian, apologized respectfully but without fear. This wasn't a city on the verge of revolt. The Tyrians had grown accustomed to being occupied. The Hrothgari were the fourth satrapy to do so, and this was their second time around. Not every nation got a turn in the occupation and spoils. Perea had had the first 2 years, and if they'd had the richest spoils to steal, they'd also had the task of putting down the most rebels. The Ilishans had ostensibly fought on Dazen's side and had no central government anyway, so they didn't get a turn. The Arbornians had preferred to trade with both sides and had entered the fight only after the Battle of Sundered Rock. They didn't get a turn either. That left the Pereans, the Atashians, the Blood Foresters, and the Hrothgari. In that order, if Corvin remembered correctly. It made sense that the people of Garriston would have their favourites, or at least those less hated, among their occupiers. It took Corvin only a bit of mental shuttling to figure that, with the Pereans replacing the Hrothgari, this would be the third time Garriston had endured the Pereans. The most easily tolerated occupiers were about to be replaced by the most hated ones. But the question his observations didn't answer was just how much fear was mixed with the hatred of the Pereans. The Pereans had put down rebels both times they'd ruled. Maybe their cruelty meant the Tyrians would think twice before taking up weapons. It might mean they would take them up more quickly. Corvin didn't know. Couldn't know without spending a lot of time in the city. Time he didn't have. The city was more cosmopolitan than it had been the last time he had visited, some 10 years ago. Before the war, Garriston had been as populous and diverse as any rich port city in the world. After the war, everyone who could leave had left, especially those who looked like they were from elsewhere. Tensions had run high. During that time, the only people in Garriston were native Tyrians and their occupiers of the moment. Apparently, with each round of occupation, a few traders and soldiers had stayed and intermarried with locals. Corvin saw two shopkeepers chatting as they swept out their open stalls with straw brooms. One woman had the traditional Tyrian caramel skin and dark, full brows and wavy hair, while the woman next to her had skin like honey and ash-blonde hair, rare even for the Hrothgari. They were dressed almost identically, bangles on their wrists, long flax skirts, hair tied back with scarves. Corvin passed an alley where children played garda together, kicking and passing a ball of wrapped leather. There were more obviously Tyrian-blooded children than any other kind, but the teams were mixed. A few mothers had gathered to watch, and they stood close to each other, regardless of what Corvin would have guessed were their origins, gossiping or shouting encouragement. Not a powder keg. That was good. A radical shift in power and lawlessness in a city where neighbour hated neighbour would have invited wanton bloodshed. Garriston had seen enough of that. The water market, basically an outsized version of what Recton had, was nearly empty, except for a few food vendors offering quick meals to passing soldiers and those who had otherwise missed dinner. Corvin bought a few skewers of rabbit and fish, marinated in a fiery Elysian pepper sauce, and kept walking. Before he headed to the Travertine Palace, Corvin walked to the Hag's Gate. Here, like the Guardian's Gate and the Lover's Gate, the statue was worked into the wall, but this time Corvin had no interest in the statue. He had come to watch the soldiers. The gates had closed for the night, though it had doubtless been a long time since raiders had dared move against the city itself. The soldiers who stood at the top of the wall were joking, laughing, talking loudly, even drinking when their superiors left. Corvin had seen archers atop the Hag's Crown and at the top of the Hag's Staff, the two towers on either side of the gate, but after the two women settled in, quivers laid down, bows unstrung, they never made a circuit of their respective posts. So, soldiers with little discipline. Soldiers who had become city guards through no fault of their own. In the first year of an occupation, the soldiers might be sent against raiders and brigands or patrol the river's length. After that, they retreated to the city and became guards. The soldierly duties came to seem extraneous, and discipline slipped. Sitting watch in towers where there was never anything to watch for soon became a post where soldiers gambled and drank. Corvin headed toward the Travertine Palace. Of course, there was no way they were going to let some peasant walk in off the street and meet their prince, so when he got close to the front gate, he ducked into an alley. After Carys had been captured, Corvin had scouted King Haradul's camp enough to decide that any attempt at rescue would be suicide. Then, as they'd rendezvoused with other generals swelling the army, most likely with forced levies, they'd turned south. Corvin had headed back to a cave outside of Recton. He was almost disappointed that thieves had never found his cache. When Recton's alcaldessa had told Corvin that he and his daughter could stay, he'd hidden away everything that could connect him to the war, both for his new home's sake and his own. He'd shaved off his distinctive beaded mustache and traded rich clothes and weapons for flaxen pants and a dyer's shop. What had seemed meagre gold in his pockets then was now a fortune in his eyes, but in the intervening years it had all been unspendable. No one in Recton had gold coins, especially not stamped with a blood forester's satrap's face. So now he pulled out the long-folded Samite tunic, swept off a portion of the ground with his hand and laid it on it. Next came a broad leather belt, embossed with crocodiles, with tiny ruby eyes in emerald-dotted swamps, with diamond-eyed herons. Last he drew out Harbinger, the sword that had passed to him only when the last of his elder brothers died. A young boy sat on the curb opposite him, silently watching, quizzical. Corvin tried to ignore him. He stripped off his long shirt and pulled out a mirror. With mirror and a skin of water, he did his best to clean himself up. Then he dried himself with the dirty shirt and pulled on his rich clothes. There was nothing to be done about his boots or pants, but the Samite tunic and the stress was going to have him sweating enough as it was. After packing his things and strapping Harbinger onto his belt and pushing his hair into something resembling order, he took a deep breath and rounded the corner, approaching the gate.
"I need to see whoever's in charge,"
Corvin said to the guards, walking like a man with purpose. One of the guards said, looking confused and glancing at the other guard. Apparently, they didn't know if he meant the governor or the prince.
"Whoever threw the governor in the bay," Corvin said, "it's an emergency."
The guards shared a look.
"Got no reason not to waste his time," one guard said to the other. "He's not exactly given us cause to screen his visitors carefully."
The other Athgari soldier grinned.
"We'll take you right to him, sir."
They didn't even ask his name. Corvin followed them, astounded by his good fortune. Apparently the prince, presumably a younger prince, or the Athgari wouldn't dare behave this way, hadn't been endearing himself to the common soldiers. Even more incredibly, the soldier marched him straight to the council room. Corvin hadn't been there in 16 years. The man rapped a quick code on the door, and the guards inside opened it. He whispered something about emergency, looks important, to the guard, and then beat a hasty retreat. The council room guard, a tall, serious Hrothgari, ushered Corvin in.
Name?
He asked quietly. Corvin stepped inside. The Hrothgari prince was leaning over a table in the council room, his back to Corvin.
Corvin Danavis,
Corvin said quietly. There was a huge, both tall and thickly muscled, ebony guard standing across from the prince, his eyes hard, studying Corvin, taking note of the sword at his side. He wore all black. This prince had some nerve, pretending to have his own black guard. When the Chromeria found out about that, it would not be pleased.
Corvin Danavis, the guard announced loudly. He says he has an emergency message, my Lord Prism.
It was like lightning hit all three men at once. The blackguard, an actual, real blackguard, for Hollum's sake, had two pistols out and his blue spectacles on half a breath after Corvin's name was announced. The Prism, not a princeling, Gavin Gyle himself, stood and turned. His lip curled.
General Danavis, it's been too long.